Good morning. Welcome to Alternative Currents. I'm Bella Johnson. History shows that people have always used intoxicants. In every age and every part of the world, people have pursued intoxication with plants, alcohol, and other mind-altering substances. In fact, this behavior has so much force and persistence that it functions much like our drives for food, sleep, and sex. This fourth drive, says psychopharmacologist Ronald K. Siegel, is a natural part of our biology, creating an irrepressible demand for intoxicating substances. In his book, Siegel draws upon his 20 years of groundbreaking research to provide countless examples of the intoxication urge in humans, animals, and even insects. Presenting his conclusions on the biological as well as cultural reasons for the pursuit of intoxication, and showing that personality and guidance often define the outcome of a drug experience, Siegel offers a broad understanding of the intoxication phenomenon, as well as recommendations for curbing the negative aspects of drug use in Western culture by designing safe intoxicants. This from the promo of his publisher, Inner Traditions, Bear & Company. I'd like to welcome Ron Siegel to the show today.
Thank you, Bella. I'm pleased to be with you.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed your book. Very informative and also written with an interesting writing style for a scientist. I really did enjoy it. Ron, when we talk about intoxicants, you mentioned several, from tobacco and alcohol to cocaine, opiates, marijuana, and hashish, and the chemically derived from LSD to the so-called designer drugs. Can you speak a little about the qualities inherent to each of these drugs, maybe even how one affects a casual user, but over time how that may change and so on?
Well, many of these drugs are the same in the sense that they change the way in which we feel. That's why people use them. They don't use them to die. They don't use them to get addicted. They don't use them to get poisoned. They don't use them to have medical problems. They use them because they change the way in which they feel. And these drugs either make you stimulated or they make you quieter and sedated, or they may confuse you and make you dizzy. And a lot of people find that to be very rewarding. And they're intoxicants because the word means entering into a state of toxicity, hence the word intoxication. All of these drugs, even the new ones, even the synthetic ones, are derived from plant chemicals. And the plants produce all of these chemicals as defensive agents to keep animals away. From a Darwinian point of view, from an evolutionary point of view, it makes really good sense for plants to have evolved this mechanism to keep animals from eating them, because all these plant drugs, taste bitter. They produce numbing sensations. They make the animal sick. And the animal will not survive if they eat too much of this, but the plant will. And we have found these plants. We have discovered them generally by watching animals, by watching what animals do. Almost every major drug we use has been discovered by our ancestors watching plants and animal interactions. Coffee was discovered in 900 AD by a shepherd who noticed that his goats were becoming abnormally frisky after eating these little red berries from the coffee plant. And he tried them, and he found that, well, he became abnormally frisky. And coffee spread throughout the world. Every drug has folklore attached to that, and it's not just folklore, because we've gone out there. My research teams have gone all over the planet. In every continent, we've studied animals interacting with these plants, and we've seen the goats eating the coffee. We have seen the elephants eating the fermented fruit and getting drunk. We have seen all of these interactions, and we realize that we're not alone. We're just another animal that finds these drugs and uses them. And it's not surprising, because our brain is wired to do this. Our brains, the Homo sapien brain, is a 3-pound sack of chemicals. Now, we're more than that, of course, but we are that too. And these chemicals include natural hallucinogens, like dimethyltryptamine, which is stronger than LSD. It includes stimulants like adrenaline. It includes opiates like endorphins that are almost as powerful as opium alkaloids. And so it's natural, if our brain runs on these chemicals, it's natural that we would find some affinity to these plants in our environment and to the derivatives of these plants. So it's not surprising that we're, being chemical organisms, we're going to interact with these other sources of chemicals. But we have learned, surprisingly, that the animals do this without a problem. They've been doing this for millions of years and surviving. And we seem to be having all the problems. We're the kings of intoxication. Why? Why are we screwing up? Because we have not learned the lessons that the animals have. We have taken these plants. We have taken the chemicals out of these the protective envelopes in these plants, concentrated them down, devised methods for injecting them directly into our blood, smoking them directly into our lungs. No animals does this. And then we ask, why do we have drug problems? We have drug problems because we're screwing around with Mother Nature. Take a look at coca. Coca was discovered in the Andes Mountains by Native Indians watching llamas chewing on the leaves. And they, like the goats eating the coffee berries, they became a little frisky and they discovered the coca. And they chew the leaves. Now, the leaves have about 0.5% of cocaine in it, just enough for most animals, except the llamas, but most animals, to stay away because it tastes slightly bitter. But even if you chew it, it's not going to be that bad because it's sort of like the same amount of caffeine and coffee. And it's about the same amount of nicotine and tobacco. Plants produce just a small amount just to keep the animals away. But now we've taken the cocaine out of the leaf, and we've concentrated it down, bypassed the taste receptors in the tongue that would have cried out no to the bitterness, bypassed the stomach, which would have thrown it up if we tried to swallow this much, and take it directly into our bodies, very quickly, rather than slowly absorbing it through chewing. And that's giving us all the problems. And I submit to you that all the drug problems we have on the planet today are due to dosages and patterns of use gone haywire. There's nothing magical about these chemicals and these drugs. They're simply certain chemicals with certain physical and physiological effects and certain behavioral possibilities. They're not evil, and they're not angelic. They're simply medicines. And the Andean Indians medicate themselves. They take this coca leaf to help them work. They use it in the mines in the mountains, just like we use coffee in the workplace in Western in the United States and other Western countries and Eastern countries and all over the world. And they use it also for toothaches. They use it for high altitude illness. They use it for a lot of different things. And they don't have really the addiction problems, the crack problems that we have today, because they're regulating how much they're using, just like the animals that we watched regulated how much they took in. The elephants were regulated by nature with the seasonal ripening of this fruit that turned them on, that they love the smell of it, and they migrate out of their way to get these this fermented fruit, and they gobble it up, and they get a little tipsy. But they use it primarily, we found, to relieve stress, to get some relief. And we've seen animals do this elsewhere. And during the Vietnam War, we saw water buffalo that were within earshot of the battles going out of their normal pastures, breaking down fences, going into the opium poppy fields and gobbling up the opium poppies. Now, why'd they do this? We would like to believe, and we're not sure because we haven't been able to interview any water buffalo that made any sense to us, but we would like to believe that they're relieving the stress of the battle. Just like the veterans who fought those wars were using smoking opium in order to relieve the stress of combat. And after the war, interestingly, those water buffalo did not continue to do that behavior. They stayed in their own pastures. So, you know, what has really impressed me over all these years, in every part of the world, in every continent, in every part of our history of this planet that I've been able to research, we see the same thing happening again and again. Animals and people are medicating themselves with various compounds to change the way in which they feel, and we need to recognize that intoxication is medicine for the human condition. And we have to start thinking of it not as drugs frying your brain, because they don't do that. Well, actually, alcohol does that. It does destroy brain tissue, but that's one of the few that do. And we have to start recognizing that drugs are medicines, and we have to try to make them as safe as we possibly can, as safe, if not safer, than the foods and water that we ingest all the time.
Well, we're so tangled up in this consumerism. We tend to give a lot of power away, I believe, to the companies that make prescription drugs, and then they take and adulterate these drugs even further. What is your take on that whole scene?
Well, as a psychopharmacologist at the medical school here at UCLA, I see all the problems with patients who are having adverse reactions to prescription medicine. We see more of those than we do see people having problems with street drugs. As a matter of fact, statistics will bear me out that more people die from prescription drug abuse than for all the illegal drug deaths put together. Every year this happens. Because these drugs are just not that safe either. There are certain benefits to these, but there's a lot of costs. And there's a kind of a simple economic rule in pharmaceutical research. If the benefits overshadow the cost, then they'll use the drug and they'll prescribe it and they'll ask patients to take it. And some of these drugs do have tremendous therapeutic benefit. But even with pharmaceutical control over the production and the purity of them, even with prescription labels that tell you when to take it and what not to take it with, even with a doctor monitoring it and monitoring your reactions, we still have problems. We know enough now that people cannot control their drug use, even under strict prescription guidelines. They take too many painkillers. They get addicted to Vicodin. They get addicted to oxycodone. They keep on going back for more. The same thing that happens with people using cocaine, people using ecstasy, people using any number of street drugs like methamphetamine, which is a big epidemic now. People cannot control them, and what we need to do is have drugs that control themselves, that are, if not perfectly safe, a hell of a lot safer than the ones we have now. And what is irritating to those of us who are on the front lines of this research is that those kinds of techniques, that technology exists. We can, through molecular architecture, we can mold these drugs to do exactly what we want. We can put them in vehicles that control themselves, like time-release capsules. We have, we developed a cocaine chewing gum, which we did some early testing with, and which is now for sale in another country. And it is a safe way of chewing, taking in the cocaine over a long period of time. There's no addiction. It has a very long therapeutic effect on depression. And we certainly don't have very good antidepressants. Most of them are prescription drugs. Most of them are what I like to call shotgun pellets in the brain. We don't know that much about depression that we can target specific areas that control depression. We throw this shotgun shell at the brain, and yeah, we make people feel a little less depressed, but we also have a hell of a lot of side effects. We don't have these silver bullets. We don't have these magic bullets that target specific things. But cocaine does. Cocaine does have a strong antidepressant effect, very, very specific effect, and a euphoric effect. And there have been some clinical trials down here in California where people have been using it to treat the depression that accompanies rheumatoid arthritis. And these are elderly patients that were in this study. They were the minimum age, I think, was 65 years of age. It doesn't stop their rheumatoid arthritis, but it makes them feel so much better that they stop taking a lot of their aspirin. They stop feeling sorry for themselves. They get a little more motivated. I examined one woman who was 80 years old, and she got out of her wheelchair for the first time in a couple of years and went square dancing. And her husband was elated because she also was able to make love with him in bed for the first time in years. Now, she still had chronic rheumatoid arthritis, but it was a nice way of making her feel a lot better and a lot more comfortable with life. And pharmaceutical medicine and medicine in general is very Calvinistic. They want patients to feel good, but not that good. They want them to feel less pain, but not all that less pain. And if it's safe, I don't see why it can't be used.
Right. I'd like to remind listeners, if you just tuned in a short time ago, we're speaking today on Alternative Currents with Ronald Siegel, author of Intoxication, out by Park Street Press, part of Inner Traditions. Ron, how much do you feel of this is political? I know you mentioned in your book different presidents and different time periods that those presidents relate to, and kind of how the intoxicants that were being done by the public kind of reflected what that president was into at the time.
Yeah, presidents are just like the rest of us. They are Homo sapiens, and they do have the same kinds of chemical brains, and they do gravitate to the same drugs. I outlined in the book some of the unknown drug history of the presidents. I kind of stopped. I think I stopped with FDR. I didn't go farther than that. I could have. Everyone knows about John F. Kennedy, about the fact that he was getting regular injections of amphetamine before the summits with Khrushchev. Amphetamines is a very workable drug. It's very useful. It was the number one drug in combat in World War II. Not only was Adolf Hitler the world's first amphetamine and methamphetamine addict, but all the Nazi panzers and most of his fighting forces were using it too. But so were the RAF pilots, and so were the U.S. forces. I think the U.S. Army dispensed 2 million doses of amphetamines during World War II. Today we're using the same thing. I don't know if our president is using amphetamines like JFK did, but we do know that our troops are. They call them go pills, and they use them in Iraq and Afghanistan now. And interestingly, most of the friendly fire accidents in Afghanistan have been related to pilots under the influence of amphetamines, taking a little too much, getting a little too jittery, a little too agitated, a little too hyperexcitable, perhaps. Or just coming down and crashing after a long mission, a nighttime bombing mission. These drugs are very useful. We want our warriors, I think, to be wide awake, to be vigilant. We don't want them sleeping on the job, especially in combat. We don't want them nodding out from marijuana or heroin the way they did in Vietnam. We want them wide awake and alert, especially in this war on terrorism. And interestingly, so do the insurgents. Insurgents have been captured in Iraq under the influence of amphetamines. They've discovered it, too, as a good warfare drug. Everybody uses these drugs for very specific purposes. I wouldn't be surprised if they're throughout all of our politics. I can tell you that, all the celebrity cases, where children of politicians have been busted with street drugs, but politicians themselves have used them. The presidents tended to use the ones that were available to them. Tobacco and alcohol were very common among American presidents in the early years of our republic. There was experimentation with cocaine and marijuana when they became fashionable among our presidents. And so, you know, I mean, even there have been unsubstantiated rumors about George Bush. And there's one book about George Bush and some of his alleged cocaine use. But this is purely rumor at this point and totally unsubstantiated. But I wouldn't be surprised to have someone who's growing up in this age to be exposed to these things and to use the ones that are around, even experimentally.
So then this war on drugs in this country, can you share your views on this nation's warrior approach to intoxicants? And
war on drugs, Bella, excuse me for jumping in there.
But no, go right ahead.
You've hit a nerve here. I get really upset with the war on drugs.
You and me both.
So because the war on drugs is a war against ourselves. It is what we are. We are drug animals. We are drug, as I said, our brains work on 3 pounds of drugs. We run on chemicals. And getting high is an unstoppable natural drive. So what we need are safe drugs. We can't say no. That don't work anymore. Mm-hmm. Our brains do not do that. The war on drugs is denial of our very nature. What we need to do is war on unsafe drugs, on uncontrollable drugs, on bad drugs, just like we war on dirty food, on contaminated beef that might give us mad cow disease. We war on pollutants in our water that might give us cancer. We war on pollutants in our air. We war on unsafe sex that might give us AIDS and other diseases. We should war on dirty drugs, dirty medicines that are unsafe at any speed. Now, I'm not saying that we should go out and use cocaine and amphetamines and these things, because actually these are not that safe either. We need totally safe. And dream with me for a moment. The way to win the war on drugs is to have drugs that work and that are perfectly safe. Dream with me for a moment. What would be wrong if we had drugs that were perfectly safe intoxicants? I mean, drugs that gave us the same effects as our most popular ones, but never caused any disease or dysfunction or death. Imagine an alcohol type of substance that never caused liver disease, never caused a hangover, never impaired driving, never caused a work break problem. Maybe you'd like to sniff a mist, a perfume mist, that is as enjoyable as marijuana or tobacco, but as harmless as clean air. How about a painkiller that is as effective as morphine, but safer than aspirin, which still kills about 12 people a day in the United States? How about a mood enhancer that dissolves on your tongue instantly, like a breath mint, and is more appealing than cocaine and less harmful than caffeine? How about a sleeping pill that allows you to choose whether you want to dream or not? Or how about a tranquilizer that's less addicting than Valium and much more relaxing than a martini? This is not science fiction. All of these drugs exist. I talk about a few of them in the book. They can be made today. The problem is that we have to find a place in our thinking that would allow us to use intoxicants as medicines, not as drugs, not as escape drugs, not because something's missing in our lives, because we want to just change the way in which we feel, which we do all the time through a lot of non-chemical ways. But we also do it through chemical ways, and that's causing a lot of problems. And by the way, I know I'm jumping around here, but you asked my feelings on the war on drugs. What happened to the war on drugs? I haven't heard about anything on the war on drugs for a few years since the war on terrorism took over.
Right.
The war on drugs was something that was created by President Nixon in the 70s. And it's sort of like a war on poverty, a war on hunger. I mean, it's... How do you war against nouns? It's really hard to do that. We should be cleaning up. And I agree with some of the law enforcement stuff that's going on, though. I mean, we got to stop some of these dirty drugs because they are killing people. They are debilitating people.
Yeah, I agree. I guess my objection comes in when the constant message is coming to kids, is don't do drugs, don't do drugs. But how many prescription drug commercials do you get in a break on an average television show?
Well, not only that, but the most dangerous drugs. There are so many ways of measuring the danger of drugs. Let's take death. Death is, everyone will agree, that's pretty dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the most dangerous drug that we have in America is tobacco.
Yep.
It kills about 1,000 people a day. The next most dangerous drug is alcohol. That kills about 500 people a day. How about cocaine? Well, less than a half a dozen deaths, and some of them due to bullet wounds. Very few anymore. LSD, none. There is no lethal dose for LSD in people. There have been found some in animals, but not in people. People have died from LSD under the influence of LSD by having accidents, by falling off of cliffs, by getting into automobile accidents, wandering into traffic, this sort of thing. But it's not toxic. The difference between the dose that turns you on and the dose that kills you is a measure of its safety. With LSD, as with aspirin, and with a lot of other drugs, there's a tremendous margin of safety. But with other drugs, there's a very narrow margin of safety. And we see alcohol and tobacco, because the dose that turns you on is the dose that is starting to poison you. Getting inebriated with alcohol, what's the message? You're getting dizzy, you're getting stuporous, you're losing your balance, you're swaying, you're being poisoned. The drug is telling you, don't take me, I'm a poison, stay away. But LSD doesn't do that. LSD just gives you a lot of funny pictures to look at, little clowns dancing on the windowsill, and people changing colors. You have to have the right place to use that. You don't use that behind the wheel of a car. You don't use that in the middle of a lecture. You don't use that in the middle of the street. You use that in a secluded, protected environment. So we need to have the right environment. Now, we think we have that for alcohol. I mean, you got to be a certain age. You have to go into a bar or a restaurant. You can't be behind the wheel. And yet it's still disastrous because alcohol is such a strong poison. We need to have not only the right drugs, but we need to have the right environments in which people can use this. And thus far, we've been unable to manage it, even with alcohol.
Okay, let's take a break. You are listening to Alternative Currents today. Our guest, Ronald Siegel, author of Intoxication, subtitled The Universal Drive for Mind-Altering Substances, published by Inner Traditions, WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 in Bangor, is now streaming live on the web, www.weru.org. We'll be back in just a minute.
Every year along about this time it all goes dry. Nothing round for love or money that'll get you high. Henry got pissed off and said he'd run to Mexico to see if he could come back holding 20 keys of gold. Now the road to Acapulco is very hard indeed, and it isn't any better if you haven't any weed. Henry's driving hard and straight on twisty mountain roads, 50 people waiting back at home for Henry's load. And now he's rolling down the mountain going fast, 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 and if he blows it, this one's gonna be his last. Went to Acapulco to turn the golden keys. Henry, keep your brakes on for this corner if you please. Henry got to Mexico and turned his truck around. He's talking with the man who has it growing from the ground. Henry tasted, he got wasted, couldn't even see. How he's gonna drive like that is not too clear.
And welcome back, little new riders of the Purple Sage, to lift your spirits there. Alternative Currents today with Ronald Siegel as a guest, author of Intoxication, The Universal Drive for Mind-Altering Substances. Welcome back, Ron.
Thank you.
Seeing as you've studied so many brain chemicals and that kind of thing, what do you feel about the stress hormone cortisol in human beings? And is that part of the drive, in your opinion, or what do you think it is?
I wouldn't call it a drive. A drive is something... First of all, a drive is some people would say, a very archaic psychological idea to explain certain trends in behavior. And they talk about the primary drives of sex, hunger, and thirst, which seems to motivate the organism to do things and to survive. And they are essential. And I'm suggesting that in just the same way, the drive to intoxication is a fourth drive. It's just as strong. And we see that there are classic examples of monkeys that will learn to press a bar to get an injection of cocaine or amphetamine all the time, to the exclusion of food, to the exclusion of water, ignoring their water tubes, ignoring the food troughs, and ignoring even the opportunity for sexual companionship with an eager monkey. And they will do this to the point where, unless the experimenter stopped the experiment, they would die. That's a drive, just like the drive to get water. The dying man that's dying of thirst, doing whatever they can to crawl across the desert to find the water. These are primary drives. Stress is a function of the animal's motivation, of the way in which he's moving, that he can undergo certain types of stress. And stress is a very complicated hormonal reaction that requires certain hormones that some animals do not have. All animals have the sex, hunger, and thirst, and as a result of my research and others, they also have the drive to intoxicate themselves. Even insects, even animals we wouldn't suspect that would do that, crave intoxicants and go out of their way to get them, and they may show signs of becoming, if not addicted, certainly very partial to these animals, to these particular plants or these sources of intoxicants. For a lot of birds, it's fermented sap, it's fermented fruit. It isn't plants per se, but there are intoxicants all over the planet. Animals can find them, and in fact, we have found them. There are over 700,000 species of plants on this planet, and only about 60 of them are being exploited for psychoactive drug effects. There are a lot out there that haven't been found, and we've been searching for new ones. And how do we search for it? We watch the animals. And we have discovered one which is kind of mind-blowing. It grows in the high Rocky Mountains. It's favored by bighorn sheep. And some of the natives, American Indians, have learned about this and have used it for an alleged narcotic effect. We have found it has a very, very potential effect, that it might be the next aspirin for humankind. It is a very, very powerful drug. The problem is that it only grows, that we know of, in one place on the planet. It may grow elsewhere. We just haven't found it. It's really hard to find. There are lots of unexploited resources. And it's kind of interesting also, when you asked me before about drug companies and their pharmaceutical research, in the jungles and on the savannas and in the mountains around the world, I have met explorers working for drug companies who are doing exactly what I'm doing. They're looking for something that they don't care if it works that well or not, or that it's the fountain of youth or not. They're looking for something they can make a lot of money on.
Right.
And mostly they're looking for antibiotics. Because antibiotics, once you're on antibiotics, you stay on antibiotics again and again and again and again. It's not one prescription. It's repeated prescriptions over and over and over again. You make a lot of money on antibiotics. And so they're looking for antibiotics. They're not looking for a new mood elevator. You don't make a lot of money on that. There aren't that many psychiatric patients. Maybe there should be, but there aren't. They're looking for drugs that help treat cancer, They're not looking for drugs to treat the nausea from chemotherapy. We got a great one that does that, and that's marijuana. Does a fantastic job of that. They're not interested in developing that one, even making it safe. Just like they're really not all that interested in making a safe cigarette. They say they have a safe cigarette. They say they have safer cigarettes. They're not interested in that because what people want is nicotine. And nicotine is the poison. We have seen animals in Africa, you know, ostriches dying within minutes after eating a couple of tobacco seeds. That's how poisonous it is to some animals. But yet we've seen baboons who live among a lot of the wild tobacco in Africa who have learned occasionally just to eat the top flowering flowers or leaves, the very young leaves that have the least amount of nicotine. They use it, appears to be, as a stimulant. They won't touch, they're smart enough, these primates, to know that the lower leaves are the ones, and the seeds are the ones that are really toxic, and they stay away from it. They won't eat them. They ignore them.
Well, I guess the source of my question was more around the extreme stress that we're living in with technology and kind of the dehumanization that seems to be around so much technology, and whether that would be part of that drive to seek, you know, more and more poisons in some kind of a self-destructive way. I'm not sure where I'm going with this now, but that's more was the source of my question about the cortisol, the stress hormone, whether that kicks in and
no,
synthesizes.
People,
I'm sorry,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. People would use drugs for a variety of different reasons. In the 60s, there was a search for meaning and individuation in people's lives. And they embraced drugs that helped them do that, like marijuana and the psychedelic drugs, that helped them explore their inner world. In the 70s, there was a culture to get back into the job place, to work, to produce, to make money. Greed is good. Remember that line from the movie?
Mm-hmm.
Cocaine was perfect for that. It was perfect for the flashy parties. It was, and the advertisements. I can remember. I was featured in three cover stories in Time magazine on cocaine through the years. The first one, and this is kind of interesting, on the cover was a martini glass filled with cocaine against the black background. That's the view of cocaine at that time. The last cover story that I did for Time magazine was called Cocaine Wars. And it showed people at war, so it changed. Now we're coming back into in the 90s. We had the rave parties, which are they're still around. We had a lot of the hip hop music. We had a lot of the rap music, which promoted the use of a lot of these drugs, which were a lot of the lyrics were written about them. A lot of it's just like the psychedelic lyrics in the 60s, and people started using some of the drugs associated with that. I recently had consulted on a legal case and testified in court about a rap artist who will remain unnamed, who had about five albums out there, and used to write his music under the influence of PCP. Angel dust. He got his inspiration from some of the crazy thoughts. And one day when he was in his apartment taking PCP, he had written a song about a devil. And this girl came in and she was wearing a t-shirt with a devil on it. And he started freaking out. He was high at the time. He started saying something to her, and she stuck out her tongue at him. And on her tongue was a pearl stud. And in his song, he had written about the devil hiding jewels inside its body. And he knew that this was just the tip of the tongue, so to speak, the tip of the iceberg. There were more jewels down below. And to make a long story short, and not to gross out your audience, he proceeded to eat her alive. Digging his way through her body, looking for these jewels, all under the influence of PCP. This is, of course, an untoward reaction. This is a psychotic reaction he had to the drug, and he wasn't using it for that purpose, and he's now going to be spending the rest of his life in jail. I believe the jury spared him the death penalty. But it illustrates how powerful these drugs are and how people are not taking them to eat other people. They're not taking them to go to jail for the rest of their lives. They're taking them to change the way in which they feel. He was using the PCP as a creative source, as an inspiration for his music. And this was, it got a little out of control, and it was a kind of a strange, bizarre confluence of events that triggered all of the thoughts of the song that he wrote, coming back at the time that he sees the girl wearing the T-shirt that he had written about.
Right. So how do we swing this whole perception around so that people would accept the safe drugs, the dream that you talked about earlier? You know, how would you institute that? How would that begin to find its way into this culture?
Well, I believe that the drugs would sell themselves. We're constantly revising and refining our medicines. We're coming out with better sleeping pills every year. And as they become better and better, people stop taking it and doctors stop prescribing the old ones. This is true for every branch of medicine. We had a drug that a lot of people, an anti-inflammatory drug called Feldene, that was taken off the market. People loved it at the time. Orthopedic surgeons would prescribe it for reduce the inflammation of back problems. They found that after many years on the market that it produced uncontrollable bleeding. And they took it off the market. And they have much better ones now that don't do any of that. So we're constantly changing our drugs and doing a lot of research. And the pharmaceutical company is spending billions of dollars a year in the research and development.
Well, they are. The thing is, the people who are doing these street drugs aren't necessarily going to go ask for a prescription. So there's almost got to be a shift in our morality.
That's right. But first of all, we have to. Well, I think there will be a shift in the use of drugs. I think that people will start using the things that are available. Right now, they are using legal drugs. For example, ayahuasca is a legal drug right now in the United States, although there's a lot of debate about that. It's an hallucinogen. I would place it in the same category as LSD. It's not prescribed, and people are using it, and it will remain legal until there are major problems with it. There's a case that's coming up before the Supreme Court. And if the Supreme Court hears it, then they'll rule on this, and we'll see what happens. But there are a lot of street alchemists. There are a lot of street researchers. There are a lot of people who are investigating these compounds in their backyard. You can't outlaw gardening. You can't outlaw horticulture or botany. These are out there, and people will find them. And when they become a problem, they'll try to make it illegal, and they'll keep on switching to something else. Eventually, one of these drugs, and there are some, we're in touch with a lot of the underground chemists who are synthesizing new compounds, and they send a lot of them to us for testing. We don't give them any feedback, but we like to monitor what's out there in the street. And by the way, our lab was the one who discovered the crack epidemic, and we discovered crack 13 years before the word was even introduced into the lexicon. We had monkeys smoking crack cocaine in the basement labs at UCLA 13 years before the word was invented, because we knew it was coming, and we wanted to make sure that we understood everything. We're working on the next ones already. Drugs that are out there now on the street that are not illegal, that people are looking at. And as drugs become safer, they will be removed. They will be removed from the controlled substance list, and people will be allowed access to it. That's happening now with certain forms of marijuana. There is a prescription form of marijuana known as Marinol, which is used for chemotherapy, because medicine and government has decided that it does have some therapeutic benefits to reduce nausea, and they are allowing that particular form of the molecule to be used. So I kind of old-fashioned in that sense. I trust the evolution of science and research, and I trust the marketplace to reject drugs that don't work. I mean, I don't know if you're, how old you are, Bella, but you may remember there was an episode of Smoking Banana Peels.
Yeah, I do remember
in the 60s.
That.
So you smoke banana peels, and the stuff that you scrape from inside banana peels, and you can get high as a kite. And we had here in California, we had signs in the grocery store limiting people to how many bananas they could buy. Just like now, you're limited in many places as to how many Sudafed tablets you can buy. And bananas, as people know by now, didn't work. You know, you can smoke all you want, and just nothing's going to happen. It wasn't a psychedelic. The marketplace will determine what works and what doesn't. And unfortunately, the lives and deaths of the users will determine what's safe and what's not safe.
Right. Again, listeners, speaking with Ron Siegel today, author of Intoxication. Ron, you mentioned the monkeys in the lab, and that was the one part of the book. The first part of your book talks about a lot of animal research, and I was kind of pleased to see in your acknowledgments, because it's such an excellent book, and I wanted to make sure that people who were animal rights activists knew that you no longer did the testing in the labs with the animals. But I kind of looked in the acknowledgments and found that, and would like it if you just kind of tell the story, if you would, about the animal patients that you worked with and how they changed your views about working with animals in the lab.
Well, it always bothered me, and I always got very close to my animals. When I was doing some research as a student with snails, it bothered me, and I stopped eating escargot, which I used to love at French restaurants. I even gave the snails individual names, painted numbers on their shells, and when we were studying the behavior. And I always let them go. I always let them go in the ivy patches around UCLA when we were done with the experiment. I never deliberately hurt an animal. I always was more of a behaviorist in terms of watching them. But we had some tragedies, and as I worked up the phylogenetic scale and got to higher and higher organisms and started working with primates, I really had an epiphany. I had very strong identification with some of the primates, and I had to stop the research. I just couldn't do it anymore. And what I switched to at that point was naturalistic observations. I went out in the field in the style of Jane Goodall. As a matter of fact, I took over one of her research stations here in Southern California after she left. When she was at Stanford for a while and ran this one. And we started working with chimps, but we just watched them. And we grew plants for them on their island. They had lived on these, there was two man-made islands in a lake that they lived in, and a game park. And we just, I didn't approve of the game park either, and that was before I started going to Africa to do it in the field. But we grew plants on the island for them and watched what they did with the plants. That's all. Photographed them and did those kinds of behavioral studies. And I found that there was enough going on in the natural world, which intrigued me. I mean, why do we have to artificially give them the drugs that we like? Let's see what they like. And they did like a lot of plant drugs. And they did use them. And we were able to look at, in a natural community, we were able to look at how it affected their whole social behavior and how they taught their young how to use it. And the chimps were very effective like that. They use a lot of medicinal plants. They use plants with antibiotic effects. They use plants for healing. Other animals do that too. I rejected all of that caged animal experimentation, which was not the kind of things that people fear you're doing, you know, sticking wires and electrodes in their brain, stuff like that. I never did that sort of thing. I always was just watching the animals, but I watched them under close conditions. Now I watch them closely under wild conditions.
Right.
And it's much more exciting. It's much slower going. And there are many weeks out there where I'm alone with a pair of binoculars and nothing happens. That's why this research is very slow going, and that's what makes it so exciting when you do find something, when you discover a new drug. We discovered a couple new drugs in South America, new psychedelic drugs. which was always nice to come across those things.
Now, Ron, we have about 4 or 5 minutes left here. I want to make sure that you say all you want to say in this interview, and if there's anything you want to cover in that time, please do. And also, is there a website that people can take a look at for more of this, all of your research? Or?
Not my stuff. I have never even Googled myself, so I don't even know what's out there.
I just found the site for Inner Traditions that's on WERU's website under Programmer's Notes.
Yeah,
if anyone's interested.
There's a lot of references in my book. I would encourage people when they're trying to get the book to get this new edition that we're talking about that is published by Park Street Press. Because that has all the corrections in it and all the up-to-date information. So it's the one to get, whether you get it from Park Street Press or you get it from Amazon.com or whatever, but you get that new edition. There's a lot of information on the Internet. I would warn people to be very wary of it, because a lot of it is not vetted. It's not... It's written without any kind of control review, like we would do in a journal article in medicine or in science, where we would have what we call peer review. You have to be very, very careful on the information that's out there. There are some websites that are better than others, believe it or not. Even with the political slant of that, the Drug Enforcement Administration's information about drugs is fairly accurate. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, their websites, their publications are very accurate. I write a lot of them for them. There are some things but you have to be very, very careful, and I would try to go to reputable websites for that information.
Okay.
Unless you want to find out what the street folklore is, then you wouldn't care.
Yeah.
You want to find out what users say about it.
Right.
And that's it. That's important, too. We monitor all that. We look at all those sites.
Because, and again, you're at UCLA?
Yes.
Yeah. Just yeah. to let listeners know where you're speaking from.
Yes. I've been here for a long, long time. I came out here... from New York, because I came out here because it was one of the few places I could do LSD research at the time, and we were giving LSD and all kinds of marijuana and all kinds of other drugs to volunteers in the laboratory, and I wanted to move away from animal research and move into people who could give informed consent and volitionally agree to all the conditions of the experiments. And it was also an exciting time because lots of new epidemics have started here in California. The psychedelic revolution started here. The methamphetamine epidemic in 69-70 started here. The crack epidemic in the form of cocaine-free base smoking started here in 1971. It hit New York in 1985. So we are always on the cutting edge of things, and it was an exciting place to be, and it still is.
Well, any closing remarks?
I would encourage people to take a look at the book, and there's a lot of information in there. There's a lot of stories, if they're interested in further information, they may want to look at some of the other books that I've written, one called Fire in the Brain and one called Whispers.
And your bibliography is about 20 pages long. It's a lot of resource there.
Yeah, yeah. More than you want, probably.
Definitely. I want to thank you very much for being our guest today on Alternative Currents, and hope people... can take a look sometime at your book, Intoxication, and decide for themselves whether the proof's in the pudding, but I found it to be quite fascinating. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And we're going to close out with the Fugs.
I went to a party the other night. I wanted to fill my brain with light. I grabbed myself a bottle and I started drinking wine. I thought pretty soon I'd be feeling fine, but I couldn't get high.
waited 30 minutes for my body to sing. I waited and I waited, but I couldn't get out. I couldn't get out. Get out. Oh. I couldn't.
Got to thank Joel Mann for that selection, and thanks for all of his wonderful engineering over many months of Alternative Currents episodes. Talk to you next month. This has been Alternative Currents, Bella Johnson on WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 in Bangor, and live streaming on the web, weru.org. Talk to you next month, first Friday of the month, 10 a.m.